Thank you very much, and dear friends and colleagues of science, Prime Minister Viktor Orban started off by saying that the subject for this conference must be the social and financial crisis in the world, and I will pursue that in line with Professor Johan Sillé's point that we also have an environmental crisis, and to argue that we have scientific justification for the need for a global mobilization in a new endeavor on integrated Earth system research for human development in an increasingly turbulent world, an initiative that in fact is now starting in a broad partnership including UNESCO, ICSU, ISSC, and also the large donors for science in the Belmont Forum and other colleagues and sponsors. Now the starting point comes really in one of the latest issues of Science that shows indicators that humanity may now in fact have entered a new geological epoch. We may be exiting the Holocene and entering the Anthropocene, anthros for humans, that we 7 billion people and the affluence in the industrial metabolism are today the largest geological force of change on the planet. And the scientific evidence is empirical and increasingly overwhelming, showing here in the indicators of, for example, overfishing, where we have today emptied out roughly 80% of the fish stocks in the oceans, and the trends of ocean acidification when the oceans buffer 25% of our emissions of carbon dioxide, and on the lower hand you see the population growth and carbon dioxide increases. This comes from work from Nobel Prize laureate Paul Crutzen, one of the scientists that identified the depletion of the ozone, stratospheric ozone depletion, that already for 5-6 years back suggested that humanity may have entered the Anthropocene. And this is now entering increasingly in the broader scientific policy domain. Normally we used to see these front pages of The Economist and Business Reviews of the vortex of the financial crisis. In May this year, even The Economist welcomed humanity to the Anthropocene. What we're seeing evidence now is that these two turbulent changes are interacting. It's remarkable to see how oil price increases, climate change affecting precipitation earlier than science had thought, is causing food security problems, which in turn propel social instability in different parts of the world. The real world is changing faster than science had predicted, particularly in climate. The Economist has this wonderful British understatement type quote to reflect that by saying that when reality is changing faster than theory suggests it should, a certain amount of nervousness is a reasonable response. And this is clearly what science is communicating now to the world society. But it's also a tremendous challenge for science to therefore move faster on understanding risks, but also identifying solutions. Now, as Professor Johan Sillé referred to, we are not only on a crowded planet, but a group of Nobel Prize laureates gathered in what is called the third Nobel Laureate Symposium on Global Sustainability, issuing the Stockholm Memorandum with a very dramatic key synthesis of science, which is the first remark on this slide, which is that humanity may have reached a saturation point. We may now be hitting hardwired processes at the planetary scale, where we can no longer exclude shifting fundamentally the operation of the Earth system and its ability to support the modern economy. And that we now need to be stewards of the broader biosphere in order to ensure stability of the planet for human development. And the climate change is but one among many processes we now need to act very decisively on. And that business as usual is not an option. We need a great transformation and moving very fast towards global sustainability. But there's another dimension of the pressures. We often talk of these things only in one dimension. But in fact, science clearly provides evidence that the planet is under a quadruple squeeze. And the first one is, of course, the demographic squeeze, which is not only numbers. It's not only that we're committed to 9 billion people. We have an equity challenge, that the problems we're facing so far are largely accumulated by the impacts of the rich minority on the planet, the 20% of the world population that stepped onto the industrial revolution 150, 200 years back. Now we have a positive momentum of the majority of the planet. We have a middle class growing in the vast billions in Asia, India, Latin America, and parts of Africa. We have the climate crisis, which is moving faster than we previously thought. But we also have an ecosystem crisis, shown in the first health control of the world's ecosystems by the UN in the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment, showing that no time in human history have we undermined ecosystem functions and services so fast as during the last 50 years. So when we need a resilient planet the most to deal with the climate problem, we actually have the weakest planet over the past 10,000 years. And as if that was not enough, complex systems dynamic resilience research shows clearly that ecosystems, from local lakes to big systems such as the Arctic are not behaving according to what we normally assume. They're not changing linearly, incrementally, and thereby predictably. They're changing in nonlinear fashion, often with multiple states and tipping points where they can provide services for a long period of time, lulling us into a comfort zone, and then suddenly, over a trigger, change very fast. This is the changing landscape that science is facing on global sustainability. So where's the evidence here? Well, the evidence is, of course, the empirical evidence we have since the industrialization until today. And we all know this curve, which is the carbon dioxide curve. We all know this curve, which is the 0.8 degrees Celsius increase since the industrialization. But it looks the same whatever parameter we choose that matters for human well-being. I'll just run through them very quickly for you, a couple of them. This is nitrous oxide over the same period. This is methane from modern agricultural development. This is stratospheric ozone depletion, now bending, luckily. Frequency of climatic disasters, overfishing of the oceans. The whole eutrophication drama in our freshwater systems and coastal zones. Deforestation in the world, expansion of agriculture, and perhaps the most dramatic one, we're in the sixth mass extinction of species on the planet. So we have this tremendous pattern of exponential growth, which then can be matched by human exploitation. And this is just the one mirror, which is that we are 3 billion people on the planet facing water scarcity with the same pattern of social ecological pressures. So it looks like this, with these multiple exponential increases, and they all bend in the mid-1950s. So 10 years after the Second World War, we're 3 billion people, the industrial metabolism goes into high gear. And this is the first time we see empirical evidence that we're starting to have impact at the planetary scale. The first warnings, as you all know, came out when we just started the journey with Rachel Carson's Silent Spring in 1966, with the Club of Rome in 1972, and the Stockholm Conference in 1972, shot down by many conventional economists and policymakers. But one reason for that, you could excuse them, was that we had barely started the journey. Now we're up at the top of an empirical journey of multiple exponential pressures on the planet. This is, ladies and gentlemen, the entry to the Anthropocene. We know we need to bend these curves very soon to avoid tipping points, not necessarily in the next decade, but into the longer-term future. Now, why aren't we acting on this? Well, one reason, of course, is that it has benefited our world economy so tremendously to actually downgrade the planet. This is one way of illustrating that in Hans Rosling's Gapminder on demographics. On the x-axis, you have one good proxy of development in the world, which is the average number of children per woman in the world, and another good proxy, which is average life expectancy in years. And as you see, world countries in balls here are increasingly gathered in the desired corner. So we've done tremendous progress, the good side of the degradation coin, and we're seeing that in dark blue, its major challenges remain in Africa and some destabilized nations in the world. So we have this paradox of one very positive social trend, but on the backside we're starting to see the increasing impacts of the negative trends. So this is the challenge of a great transition. Now, we cannot only stop there because this only shows the pressures. But what are the potential risks of the pressures? Well, that's where the whole insights from science and nonlinear change comes in. So we often believe that ecosystem change linearly, as suggested in the upper left-hand corner, but we see that the universal pattern seems to be threshold and rapid change when we put pressure on systems. This is increasingly evidenced from knowledge of tremendous depth. And what we're seeing is, and we often illustrate this in this cup and bowl illustration, for our students, which is that an ecosystem in the ball here is in a deep cup, and the deeper it is, the more resilient it is to change. It can withstand a disturbance while still rock in the same desired high delivery of ecosystem, biodiverse coral reefs, clear water systems with a lot of fish, good savanna systems. We exploit these systems and they stay in the desired state, but they get more and more shallow over time, and they lull us into this comfort zone of being able to deliver. But a trigger can easily push the whole system over a threshold, and a feedback kicks in, and the system changes state. It moves into an entirely new state, which does not deliver human well-being in the same level. We're starting to see these risks climbing in scale. And here's perhaps the most significant hotspot on the planet. You all know this curve, I'm sure, which is the loss of sea level summer ice in the Arctic. And we see the drama in 2007 when suddenly the Arctic loses 30% of its summer ice cover in 3 months. This was a total shock for science because it was not predicted. And it indicates the risk of a tipping point in the Arctic because the feedback is known that when a surface that should look like this, reflecting incoming solar radiation, changes to a darker color like this, absorbing radiation, we have an accelerating feedback mechanism that could lock the system into losing its ice cover, which in turn would have a feedback on the global economy because it would increase temperature with potentially up to 1 degree Celsius. The other hotspot is clearly the world's tropical coral reef systems. Here we have the update from the World Resources Institute 10 years after the first reef risk, showing that by 2050, because not only of climate change, but because of eutrophication, overfishing, and unsustainable tourism, we cannot exclude losing up to 90% of the hard coral reef biodiversity-rich tropical reef systems in the world. This is because of tipping points when systems topple over and lose hard coral systems to soft coral dominance. And we're seeing examples of moving from this desired state to this undesired state, knocked over by triggers in terms of extreme El Niño events. These systems support 250 million people in coastal regions in the world. So this is a major social risk of tipping points in some of these hotspot regions. And we're starting to see the importance of biodiversity to keep systems in desired state. This is a phenomenal paper in Science showing that when we lose top apex consumers, we have trophic cascading in food webs that could make systems more vulnerable and tip faster. This came out just last week in Science, showing that forest systems might be more vulnerable to tipping points, and that we cannot exclude that even in the Brazilian Amazon system, it could tip more rapidly into savanna systems if we push the system too hard in terms of deforestation and climate change impacts. These instabilities in big biomes on the planet is not only dramatic for nation-state economy, they're regulators of the global planetary stability, and therefore also a global concern. Now, what happens then in my final section here if you combine these two insights? The insight of the Anthropocene, the pressures, and the insight of nonlinear change, the tipping points. Well, it does change the agenda, because suddenly we may have to ask ourselves as scientists, do we have to put the planet in the pot? Do we have to, for the first time, consider the risk that we as humans are changing fundamentally the state of planet Earth to sustain humanity? Well, to start this investigation, we need to, of course, define a desired state. And increasingly, science has, through tremendous progress, been able to deliver that, we think. Because we have ice core data now in so good time steps that we can present these kind of evidence. This is the last 100,000 years. This is from Greenland. And this is, on the y-axis, a good proxy for living conditions on the planet in temperature Celsius. It's a good period because it's roughly half the time we've been fully modern humans on the planet. So we've had more or less the same ability to develop societies as we know them. This was, as you all know, a jumpy ride indeed. For most part of this time, we're hunters and gatherers. We have a rough time. We're 2 to 40 million people on the planet. And we enter, in the last stage, the Holocene, this remarkably stable, warm interglacial. We barely enter it, and we domesticate animals and plants. We invent agriculture. And we take off into the civilizational journey we all know. And we end up in this fantastic building in Budapest, celebrating the fantastic advancements of science. We're 3 billion people at the takeoff point. We're 7 committed to 9. The variability of human conditions on the planet here are remarkably small. The planet varies plus minus 1 degree Celsius. We have more and more knowledge of the variability within which the planet should stay in order to keep the biome in its Holocene state. Our conclusion is to take a responsible challenge of feeding and human well-being for 9 billion people, we need to remain in the Holocene state, the only state we know that can support the modern civilization as we know it. Well, if you take that conclusion, you can then actually start tapping science to define what we've called a safe operating space for humanity through a framework we've defined through very, very major advancements in Earth system research, which we call planetary boundaries, which is basically to ask ourselves the question, what are the Earth system processes we need to be guardians of to stay in a Holocene-like state in the Anthropocene? How can we guard the processes that seem to have feedbacks and regulatory functions? And it includes not only climate change, but of course, biodiversity, land use, fresh water, air pollution, stratospheric ozone layer, ocean acidification, chemical pollution, and the very important issue of biodiversity. In green here, you have an attempted quantification of that safe operating space. And as you see, for climate, biodiversity, and eutrophication, we seem already to be in a danger zone. And we're seeing the examples in the warnings from the Arctic. This is a way to help science and challenge science in its next step on integrated research. Now, to close in just a final remarks, how does this connect then to the most social and economic area of science? Well, this is the journey we need to make, dear friends. This is the fossil fuel-free world we need to attain in 2050 to stay under 2 degrees with a 70% likelihood of success. A fossil fuel-free world. And as we increasingly know, to do that journey, as the Ban Ki-moon High-Level Panel on Global Sustainability is pointing out, these are the scenarios for the Ban Ki-moon High-Level Panel, even with the best policy reforms, we would be actually transgressing many of the planetary boundaries in the scenarios that we've provided for the panel, particularly on climate, biodiversity, and nitrogen. So we have an enormous task, which also is connected to equity and livelihood improvements. And we know that economic growth and new science in economics is therefore needed, because the conventional economic growth does not deal with discontinuities, limited substitutability, rebound effects, equity, resource scarcity. If we are in the Anthropocene, we need to share resources within absolutes, not pricing things only on the market, and deal with relatives. Growth is currently unsustainable. Degrowth is also unsustainable. As shown from the Brazilian case, we cannot promote human well-being and scientific endeavors without growth. But on the other hand, we have these kind of insights coming more and more clearly that, you know, it seems like it's a very potentially livable future to be in a low-carbon economy. So my final slide here will be to suggest that at least one area of solutions is on the way we produce food in the world. The other one would clearly be a grand transition on energy. We just published here in Nature one scientific synthesis on the evidence shown that we can actually do a transition to sustainable agriculture in the world by intensifying agriculture and still feed 9 billion people. So all this, we believe, could form a very exciting journey for science in a new Earth system endeavor for global sustainability. This initiative, which I started off with, is now led by an alliance, including the Belmont Forum, UNESCO, ICSU, ISSC, and partners. And it all has to do with defining, over the next 12 months or so, an agenda for a step change in research to deliver what society must demand from science to guide this transition. And it's a broad partnership. The working name is so far Earth System Sustainability Initiative. And we look forward to work with all of you in this room in making this endeavor a reality. Thank you very much.